Pharaoh's delight in Memnon was even more poignant than usual. The child and the promise that he had wrung from my mistress were his hope of immortality. Against my wishes, he kept the child with him until after sunset. I knew that Memnon's boundless energy and his demands for attention were tiring the king, but I could not intervene until it was time for the prince's supper, and he was led away by his nurses. My mistress and I stayed on at the king's bedside, but he fell almost instantly into a death-like sleep. Even without his white makeup, he was as pale as the linen sheets on which he lay. The next day was the third since the wounding, and therefore the most dangerous. If he could survive this day, then I knew I could save him. But when I woke in the dawn, the cabin was thick with the musky stench of corruption. When I touched Pharaoh's skin, it burned my fingers like a kettle from the hearth. I called for my mistress, and she came stumbling through from her alcove behind the curtain where she slept. "What is it, Taita?" She got no further, for the answer was plain upon my face. She stood beside me as I unbound the wound. The binding up is a high art of the surgeon's skills, and I had sewn the linen bandages in place. Now I snipped the threads that held them and peeled them away. "Merciful Happy, pray for him," Queen Lostris gagged at the stench. The crusted black scab that corked the mouth of the wound burst open, and thick green pus poured out in a slow and viscous stream. "Mortification," I whispered. This was the surgeon's nightmare, this evil humour that struck upon the third day and spread through the body like winter fire in the dry papyrus beds. "What can we do?" she asked. And I shook my head. "He will be dead before nightfall," I told her. But we waited beside his bed for the inevitable. As the word spread through the ship that Pharaoh was dying, so the cabin filled with priests and women and courtiers. We waited in silence. Thanos was the last to arrive, and he stood at the back of the throng with his helmet under his arm, in the position of respect and mourning. His gaze rested not on the deathbed, but upon Queen Lostris. She kept her face averted from his, but I knew that she was aware of him in every fibre of her body. She covered her head with an embroidered linen shawl, but above the waistband of her skirt she was naked. Since the prince had been weaned, her breasts had lost their heavy burden of milk. She was as slim as a virgin, and childbirth had not scarred her bosom or her supple belly with silver lines of stria. Her skin was as smooth and unblemished as though it had been freshly anointed with perfumed oil. I laid wet cloths upon Pharaoh's burning body in an attempt to cool the fever, but the heat evaporated the moisture and I was forced to change them at short intervals. Pharaoh tossed about restlessly and cried out in delirium, haunted by all the terrors and monsters of the other world who waited to receive him. At times he recited snatches from the Book of the Dead. From childhood the priests had taught him to memorize the book that was the key and the map through the shades to the far fields of paradise. "The crystal path has 21 turnings. The narrow way is thin as the blade of bronze. The goddess who guards the second pylon is treacherous and her ways are devious. Lady of flame, whore of the universe, with the mouth of a lioness, your vagina swallows men up. They are lost in your milky dugs." Gradually his voice and his movements became weaker, and a little after the sun had made its noon, he gave one last shuddering sigh and was still. I stooped over him and felt for the life throb in his throat, but there was none, and the skin was cooling under my touch. "Pharaoh is dead," I said softly, and closed the lids over his staring eyes. "May he live forever." The mourning cry went up from all who were assembled there, and my mistress led the royal women in the wild ululation of grief. It was a sound that chilled me and made invisible insects crawl upon my skin, so I left the cabin as soon as I was able. Thanos followed me out onto the deck and seized my arm. "You did all in your power to save him," he demanded roughly. "This was not another of your devices." I knew that this unkind treatment of me was an expression of his own guilt and fear, so I was gentle in my reply. "He was slain by the Hyksos arrow. I did all that was in my power to save him. It was the destiny of the mazes of Amun-Ra, and there is no guilt or fault in any of us." He sighed and placed one strong arm around my shoulders. "I had not foreseen any of this. I thought only of my love for the Queen and for our son. I should rejoice that she is free, but I cannot. Too much is lost and destroyed. All of us are merely grains of Dara corn in the grinding mill of the mazes." "There will be a time of happiness for all of us hereafter," I reassured him, although I had no basis for this claim. "But there is still a sacred duty on my mistress, and through her on you and me also." And I reminded him of the oath that Queen Lostris had sworn to the king, that she would preserve his earthly body and give it proper burial to allow his Ka to move on to the fields of paradise. "Tell me how I can help in this," Thanos replied simply. "But remember that the Hyksos is sweeping through the upper kingdom ahead of us, and I cannot guarantee that Pharaoh's tomb will not be violated. Then, if needs be, we must find another tomb for him. Our first concern must be to preserve his body. In this heat it will be decaying and crawling with maggots before the sun sets. I am not skilled in the embalmer's art, but I know of only one way in which we can keep our trust." Thanos sent his sailors down into the barge's hold, and they swung up one of the huge clay jars of pickled olives from our stores. Then, under my instructions, he emptied the jar and refilled it with boiling water. While the water was still hot, he mixed into it three sacks of the finest quality sea salt. Then he filled four smaller wine jars with the same brine and set them all out on the deck to cool. In the meantime, I was working alone in the cabin. My mistress had wanted to help me. She felt that it was part of her duty to her dead husband, but I sent her away to care for the prince. I slit open Pharaoh's corpse down the left flank from ribs to hip bone. Through this opening I removed the contents of chest and belly, freeing them along the diaphragm with the knife. Naturally I left his heart in place, for this is the organ of life and intelligence. I left the kidneys also, for these are the vessels of water and represent the sacred Nile. I packed the cavity with salt, then sutured it closed with catgut. I did not have an embalming spoon to push up through the nostrils and remove that soft yellow mush from the gourd of the skull, so I left it in place. In any event, it was of no importance. The viscera I divided into its separate parts, liver, lungs, stomach, and entrails. I washed out the stomach and intestines with brine, which was a loathsome task. When this was done, I took the opportunity to examine the king's lungs minutely. The right lung was healthy and pink, but the left lung had been pierced by the arrow and had collapsed like a punctured bladder. It was filled with rotten black blood and pus. I was amazed that the old man had lived so long with such an injury. I felt that I was absolved. No physician could have saved him, and there was no fault or failure in my treatment. At last I ordered the sailors to bring in the cool jars of brine. Thanos helped me to fold Pharaoh's body into the fetal position, and we placed him in the olive vat. I made certain that he was completely immersed in the strong brine. We packed his viscera into the smaller, canopic wine jars. We sealed all the jars with pitch and wax and lashed them securely into the reinforced compartment below decks in which the king stored his treasure. I think Pharaoh must have been content to rest thus, surrounded by gold and bars of silver. I had done my best to help my mistress make good her vow. In Thebes I would hand the king's body over to the embalmers, if the Hyksos had not arrived there first, and if the city and its inhabitants still existed by the time we reached it. When we reached the walled city of Asyut, it was apparent that the Hyksos had left only a small force to invest it, and had continued southwards with their main army. Even though it was merely a detachment with less than 100 chariots, the Hyksos besiegers were far too strong for us to attack them with our decimated army. Thanos' main aim was to rescue Remren and his 5,000, who were within the city walls, and then to push on upriver to join forces with Lord Nembet and his 30,000 reinforcements. Anchored out in the main stream of the river, secure from attack by those deadly chariots, Thanos was able to signal his intentions to Remren on the city walls. Years before, I had helped Thanos draw up a system of signals, using two coloured flags by means of which he could spell out a message to any other within sight, across a valley from peak to peak, or from city wall to plain and river. With the flags, Tunnus was able to warn Remren to be ready for us that night. Then, under cover of darkness, 20 of our galleys raced into the beach below the city walls. At the same moment, Remren threw open the side gates, and at the head of his regiment fought his way through the Hyksos pickets. Before the enemy were able to harness their horses, Remren and all his men were safely embarked. Immediately, Tunnus signalled the rest of the flotilla to weigh anchor. He abandoned the city of Asyot to sack and plunder, and we bore on upstream under oars. For the rest of that night, whenever we looked back over the stern, we saw the flames of the burning city lighting the northern horizon. "Let those poor bastards forgive me," Tunnus muttered to me. "I had no choice but to sacrifice them. My duty lies south of here in Thebes." He was soldier enough to make the hard choice without flinching, but man enough to grieve bitterly over it. I admired him then as much as I loved him. Remren told us that our signal frigates had sailed past Asyut the previous day, and that by now the dispatches that I had drawn up on Tunnus' behalf must be in Lord Nembet's hands. Remren was also able to give us some intelligence and news of the Hyksos and his sweep to the south. Remren had captured two Egyptian deserters and traitors who had gone over to the enemy and who had entered Asyut to spy on the defenders. Under torture they had howled like the jackals they were, and before they died had told Remren much about the Hyksos that was of value and interest to us. The Hyksos king, whom we had so disastrously encountered on the plain of Abnab, was named Salatis. His tribe was of Semitic blood, and originally a nomadic and pastoral people who had lived in the Zagros Mountains near Lake Van. In this, my first impression of these terrible Asians was confirmed. I had guessed at their Semitic origins from their features, but I wondered how a pastoral people had evolved such an extraordinary vehicle as a wheeled chariot, and where they had found that marvellous animal that we Egyptians now spoke of as a horse, and feared as though it were a creature from the underworld. In other areas, it seemed that the Hyksos were a backward people. They were unable to read or write, and their government was a harsh tyranny by their single king and ruler, this bearded Salatis. We Egyptians hated him, and feared him even more than we did those wild creatures that drew his chariot. The chief god of the Hyksos was named Sutek, the god of storms. It needed no deep religious instruction to recognize in him our own dreaded Seth. Their choice of god was fitting, and their behaviour did the god honour. No civilized people would burn and plunder and murder as they did. The fact that we torture traitors cannot be weighed in the same scale as the atrocities committed by these barbarians. It is a truth that I have often observed, that a nation chooses its gods to suit its own nature. The Philistines worship Baal, and cast live infants into the fiery furnace that is his mouth. The black Cushite tribes worship monsters and creatures from the underworld with the most bizarre rituals. We Egyptians worship just and decent gods who are benevolent towards mankind and make no demands for human sacrifice. Then the Hyksos have Sutek. It seemed that Remren's captives were not the only Egyptian traitors travelling with the enemy host. With a hot coal in his anus, one of Remren's captives had told of some great Egyptian lord from the Upper Kingdom, who sat upon King Salatis' war council. When I heard this, I remembered how I had wondered at the knowledge that the Hyksos had displayed of our order of battle upon the plain of Abnab. I had guessed then at the presence of a spy among them who knew our secrets. If any of this was true, then we must expect that the enemy knew all our strengths and weaknesses. They must know the plans and defences of all our cities. Especially they would know of that rich treasure that Pharaoh had accumulated in his funerary temple. Perhaps this explains the haste with which King Salatis is driving on towards Thebes, I suggested to Tunnus. We can expect them to attempt a crossing of the Nile at the first opportunity that presents itself to them. And Tunnus cursed bitterly. If Horus is kind, he will deliver this traitorous Egyptian lord into my hands. He punched his fist into the palm of his other hand. We must prevent Salatis from crossing the river. Our ships are the only advantage that we hold over him. I must exploit them to full advantage. He stamped about the deck and looked up at the sky. When will this foul wind swing back into the north? Every hour the enemy's chariots draw further ahead of us. Where is Nembet's fleet? We must join our forces and hold the river line.